Hello and welcome to another episode of Consumer, the European podcast of the Consumer Choice Center. My name is Bill Wirtz with Billy Joel's Pressure fading out in the background as always. And this is the episode of Thursday, September 30th, 2021. This is the last episode of September. I hope you had a wonderful end of summer September as we usually get them in Europe. And I got a great episode for you today. My guest is a returning guest, actually, Tom Spencer. He's an associate contributor for Young Voices and the chief organizer at the London Neoliberals. We'll be chatting about Brexit divergence. Which rules can the UK get rid of that it previously had because of the European Union? Which one makes sense? And, you know, which direction will the country go? So that you will listen to at the end of this episode. Also in this episode, I'll be chatting to my colleague Yala Sawski, who published a new policy note on Bitcoin, crypto regulations overall. And also in this episode, we'll be talking a bit about gene editing, because there seem to be some movements there. So let's get started. First off, I wanted to play the recording I made in short interview with my colleague Yala Sawski about crypto regulations, a new policy note that he's published. So take it away. So Yael, you just released with our fellow Alexander Kokotovich a new policy note, and it's Principles for Smart Crypto Regulation. What are the principles? What do we need to know?
Oh, that's a good question, Bill. Look, there's a lot of stuff that's happening in the crypto sphere online when it comes to digital currencies, when it comes to projects like Bitcoin and Ethereum. And we have governments around the world that are aiming to crack down. We have had, I think the most prominent example of when this came to the fore had to do with the U.S. Senate. And there was an amendment that was put forward. This had to do with essentially how crypto and crypto transactions would be used to pay for various aspects of the large infrastructure bill, something to the tune of $3 trillion. And essentially in President Joe Biden's statement about how this would be funded, he had mentioned cryptocurrency transactions, and then it was essentially left to the Senate, basically put together this plan that would be very, very ham-handed, that would be very, very far-reaching, much more than we've seen in any other country. Eventually, all of the amendments to try to change that failed, much like the American system. We still don't have that final bill, so I couldn't tell you what it is at the moment. But that was sort of the beginning of the recognition that there needs to be some set of rules around the entire crypto sphere. I think many of us are very much into these technologies. I definitely am someone who have been into this a long time. Bill, I know that you're very interested, and I know a lot of other people are. Consumers like this stuff. It's innovative. It's the future. It's cryptography. It's using digital values. And a lot of things that are focused on when it comes to regulation has everything to do with money, has to do with taxation. But the principles that we wanted to put forward go much beyond that. It's, let's think about all of the industries, all of the technology. So the kind of four principles that we put forward is, number one is preventing fraud. I think that's very important because there are a lot of crypto projects that are bunk and do steal a lot of money and essentially are breaking ordinary fraud laws and rules, but you know, we're not necessarily getting enforcement action there. The second one is technology neutrality. I know it's very, very pressing to have the government's hand in all of this, and everyone wants to invite the government and to try to set a standard. But we say not to do that at all. The government has to be technologically neutral. That way, whether it's proof of work, whether it's proof of stake, whether it's some other protocol, there shouldn't be a favored protocol by government. Let's allow the best to compete, and then we can really see what great permissionless innovations we have. Then it's reasonable taxation. I don't think I need to say it more there. We don't want to push all this stuff into other jurisdictions. And then lastly, legal certainty and transparency. People have to know what the rules are. They have to be very clear. There cannot be 18,000 loopholes. And this is something that I believe should apply not just in the European Union, in the US, Canada, pretty much every developed democracy should have these rules.
Is the fact that we need some sort of conversation about the regulatory frameworks. Is it because there are now countries that want to completely ban crypto altogether? You know, the China's decision recently to say, well, all crypto is illegal activity, we cannot allow it. And so there needs to be, in order to prevent that, we need to have some sort of conversation about a regulatory framework. Is that the motivation here also for you?
I think really what it comes down to is that the governments and states and central banks are more following what the crypto markets are doing, what the innovators are doing. If we look today, you know, the market capitalization of all cryptocurrency projects, at least the main ones, is somewhere to the tune of $1.8 trillion, which is immense. It's huge. I mean, this is the size of a country. And I think that's where you kind of see that there are a lot of alternatives that have grown up. There are all these different products that exist in decentralized finance where people are able to take out loans, they're able to earn interest, they're able to do all of these things outside of the traditional banking system. I think that is something that is alerting a lot of people in various countries, a lot of regulators, a lot of people who are just looking for that money, as I mentioned, but also for a lot of people who are looking to innovate. And I think that's kind of the next wave of this. And that's why we at the Consumer Choice Center want to be sure that we're very present in saying, yes, consumers need to be protected from dubious projects, but we also need to be sure that there are clear rules, because that's how we're going to have the best innovations. That's how we're going to have the best products. And that's how we know, whether we happen to be in Luxembourg or Belgium or France or Austria, that we are going to have access to these great projects and they can add value to our life. If we just look at the enforcement side, we're going to have a situation like in South Korea or China, where essentially exchanges or mining or transactions overall are made illegal. And that's not what we want. I think another example of something that is moving things is El Salvador. In the country there, they did make Bitcoin a legal tender. There are some arguments about how effective that has been, but it means that a country is all in now on this sort of crypto revolution. I think, if anything, that means we need to take a moment and really understand what kind of rules should be around this worldwide.
Principles for Smart Crypto Regulation. You can find the new policy note under the publications page of consumerchoicecenter.org. Yael, thank you so much. In other news then, gene editing keeps being on the agenda of the European Union. This is because there seems to be a reconsideration of gene editing rules in the United Kingdom, as it has already left the European Union, something we'll be also talking about in the next segment. Also, U.S. Secretary of State for Agriculture, Mr. Tom Vilsack, was at the Politico Future of Food and Farming Summit, where he said this, quote, "I think there is potentially a common understanding on the opportunities for gene editing. I think there's a slightly different attitude that at least I have seen in my discussions with individuals from the EU. So there seems to be a concept, at least in the United States, that there's a way to work around the differences on gene editing. But maybe he's also hinting at a policy change in the EU. As you might know, the European Union is working on a reconsideration of the 2001 GMO directive, which currently outlaws genetic modification in the European Union, largely outlaws genetic modification in the European Union. So we might see some changes there. And I think that's for the better, especially if you look at the news. Japan authorized a gene-edited tomato, and very interesting, there's not just environmental benefits, but also health benefits to this tomato. I'm quoting here from the American Council on Science and Health. Quote, "The crop is engineered to produce higher levels of gamma-aminobutyric, GABA is basically the acronym here, which is naturally found in tomatoes and widely consumed as a supplement to help manage hypertension. Unlike many of the natural health products available online or at CVS, there appears to be a decent evidence showing that GABA supplementation does what it's intended to do, reduce high blood pressure, a risk factor for heart disease and stroke." So end of quote there. Very interesting. I think overall the immense opportunities on gene editing is clear. We already have research in Europe where you can make gluten-free wheat and nuts that don't cause allergies through genetic engineering, specifically gene editing. And I think these products are just amazing. And unfortunately, we as Europeans were instrumental in the development of this technology, but unfortunately we're not allowed to use it in European agriculture. And hopefully there will be a moment where the European Union can actually reconsider its rules and look for innovation rather than an over-interpretation of the precautionary principle. Of course, if you're interested more on gene editing, there's a lot of publications that we have under the publications page of consumerchoicecenter.org, a lot of it that I've written and that you can check out to learn more about genetic engineering and why it's great and why we should have more of it to fight climate change, to also make sure we have a food system that is adequate and is able to feed the billions of people and the billions to come in the global food system. So I think there's a lot of great innovation yet to come there, and we just need to open the markets to these innovative products. But now let's move to the interview of this week. My guest is a returning guest, Tom Spencer. He's an associate contributor for Young Voices and the chief organizer for the London Neoliberals. We were chatting about the UK divergence from EU rules. What can the UK actually do? What will it do? So interesting conversation there. So take it away. So Tom, having you back on because I've been reading the news from the UK, and the UK, I mean, there's always like a million things going on in your country, so we never know exactly what should be the news of the day. But one of the news that is interesting to me is that the UK government is looking at which laws to repeal following the fact that Brexit is now completed. So which laws can be changed, which EU regulations that the UK consider to be harmful to its economy and its overall regulatory system should be altered. So I was kind of curious, how exactly is this process going to work out? What are the steps that the UK government has to go through to even make these changes?
So effectively, in the UK, Parliament is sovereign. Anything Parliament wants to do, it can do. That's the basic sort of fundamental basis of our constitutional law. So what it seems the government are looking at is to do a great deregulatory bill, and it's going to try and get all the post-Brexit improvements done in this one legislative agenda, which will hopefully bring all the benefits to Brexit, which we've been hearing about since 2016. So the main things they seem to be looking to reform is procurement, financial services, data, GMOs. There's a real big variance in what they've identified are things which are very bad regulation currently in place, which have been imposed on us by virtue of our previous membership of the European Union, which they think repealing them will bring a lot of benefits to the UK.
So to what extent are we, is the conversation in the UK conditional on how does this hamper our relationship with the EU that we have right now? Because when the UK left, most of the rules were still in place. Now, as the UK gradually gets rid of some EU rules and there's divergence between EU rules and UK rules, that could influence the relation, the trading relationship. How much of that is actually a conversation in the UK? Like, will this affect our trading relationship with the EU?
Well, I think the conversation on this is very, very quiet, actually, but I think it does need more attention being brought to it. So the more we diverge from European regulation, the larger the barriers will be to trade with Europe. We still do not have a complete financial deal in place, for example. And if we massively diverge on something like Solvency II, which is a really foundational part of European insurance regulation, it does seem to me less likely that we will see a proper financial deal made with trade. But what I think the government have been quite smart in doing is they've announced all these massive changes, but they're all in highly technical things which the public probably won't be able to digest very well. And also they've done it at a time which is during party conference season, so everything is distracted by that. We've got a fuel crisis, everyone's distracted by that. This really isn't on the news agenda at the moment, so it probably won't receive the proper public scrutiny, which it should have.
That is very interesting. But it also seems that, I mean, on EU Brexit related issues, the whole conversation of like labor shortages now with the logistics, with the lorry drivers that are missing, that is putting the UK's exit back into focus. It seems to me also that these sort of positive changes as they want to frame them, like diverging from EU rules, is sort of trying to counterbalance, to try and make the argument like there's downsides and upsides from leaving the European Union and we'll give you the upsides.
I think no one was ever so naive, or at least no one I'd respect was so naive to say that Brexit wouldn't come with costs. It always was going to distance our relationship with Europe, and the way we're going to measure if it was a success or not is in the long run how much the divergences improve us and how much our sort of diverted path sees us on a better track. Right now it's far too early to know if Brexit will be a long run success, because we haven't really done anything out of Brexit yet. We've done some minor immigration things which I wouldn't support anyway, so I've yet to see the success of the Brexit, but if we do manage to sort these deregulations out, then it could be a success. But what I would also say is the current HGV driver shortage, I think it's probably unfair to blame that on Brexit. We're seeing about a shortage of about 100,000 drivers. In normal time, we've had one of about 50,000. We've got about 10,000 less coming from Europe. But the real problem was that you couldn't train new HGV drivers during lockdown. So we just simply have a regulatory barrier where, because people can't get their license, then they can't do the job. But it has definitely been exacerbated by Brexit.
So these whole conversations about due to Brexit, despite Brexit, seems to be continuing on in the UK. And as you mentioned, the entire regulatory reforms that will now be made are not as much in focus as the whole conversation whether Brexit was a good idea or not, which has been going on for like 5 years now. Do you think there will ever be a break and the political conversation will be about which rules to align with the EU, which rules to keep, which rules to diverge from, and not really so much this kind of like looming conversation about was this referendum a good idea in the first place? Like, how long will it actually take for the UK to get over it?
I think at the political level, MPs have kind of moved to that already. You'll see someone like Keir Starmer, who is currently leader of the Labour Party and was a very rabid people's voter. He didn't want anything to do with Brexit. But now he says, yeah, Brexit's happening. We need to find a way to make it as successful as possible. And he says his job right now is to scrutinise the government and make sure they're making the best out of what he considered to be a bad situation. But you don't even hear him now saying it is a bad situation, even though everyone knows that's his thoughts. At the sort of public level and population discourse, people generally prefer the bigger questions. It's not whether this aspect is good, whether this aspect is bad. It's just Brexit good, Brexit bad. But I do think we're kind of moving on a lot from Brexit. People don't really talk about it as much. It's just something in the background. People are more concerned with just day-to-day political issues rather than these broad questions of constitutional makeup.
Do you think that the policy bubble in London is now less concerned with sort of the, well, you wouldn't really call it foreign policy issues previously because it was EU policy issues, but like do people in London look across the pond less now that the UK is, well, on its own, quote unquote?
Well, certainly from my background, looking across the EU has never really been a good idea if you're coming from that sort of libertarian free market background, because the EU tends to be a step towards the more authoritarian status look at things than the UK leans. I think there are still lessons to be learnt from the EU, and people do definitely see positives. So when we're looking at like potentially nations like Germany, nations like the Netherlands, there are good policies to be learned, but I think people tend to look more to sort of America, to New Zealand, places like that as examples that we should be following. And I'm not sure if that's due to just the language barrier, due to history or anything in particular, but I think the EU definitely comes second or third when we're looking at places to copy.
Well, ironically, I mistakenly said across the pond, not across the channel. So you already jumped on that immediately there. And I think it's very interesting because the whole conversation about CANZIC, free trade agreements between Canada and even New Zealand and Australia already concluded. So yeah, it seems to me that there seems to be this language association and not as much looking to Europe. Is that because, is there actually a feeling in the UK that the continent, the European continent, the EU, is not actually forward-looking on trade, on technology, on innovation, that it's sort of like a dying continent and there is more opportunities, there's more tech giants in other parts of the world. Is it the feeling that Europe is this declining economic bloc and there's really nothing to gain from it anymore?
I think for many that is actually one of the prime reasons why they voted for Brexit. If you look at economic growth in the EU after, say, 2008 has been pretty much zero. Europe has been going on a very steady decline, and if a country wants to be closer to the fastest growing economies, that simply isn't Europe. It's very big and a productive bloc, but it's simply not it probably won't be in 30 years, 50 years. So I think that very much does motivate it. But what I would also say is that things like CANZIC are sort of policy wonks' dreams, but I can't see it happening. I think there's a few MPs in the Canadian Parliament, one or two in Australia. No one is really talking about it here apart from a few think tanks. It's a fantastic idea in that it combines the public polling. So the public tend to want more immigration from America, New Zealand, places like this, and they tend to want less from sort of Poland, Romania, which sort of just the prejudices of people. But if you can use people's prejudices to have more immigration, then that's probably a good thing. So I think that's what it's all about, really, finding a way to get the most liberal free market reforms in a way that doesn't piss off too many people.
Yeah, that's interesting, and especially because given the results of the Canadian election, I don't think CANZIC has as intent. I mean, with a conservative majority in Canada, it could have become something bigger, but as it stands right now in Canada, it doesn't seem to be in the immediate future there. Overall, I think very interesting, Tom. I think lastly, what I think the whole continent, what the whole European Union is asking itself is whether the UK will ultimately, over the next few years, choose a path of limited diverging from EU rules, trying to keep a good relationship, trying to sometimes cosmetically change the rules to appeal to the voters of Brexit that, you know, something has been done, or whether the UK will actually try a model which is so fundamentally different from the EU and seek its trading partners abroad and really show that distinction between being a member of the EU and not being a member of the EU and being able to be successful outside of the EU. And that kind of question really is very interesting in Brussels to see what road the UK will go down. So again, big question at the end there and last question of the segment, but where do you see the UK in those next 10, 20 years? Do you think in 20 years we'll look at the UK and be like, wow, they made it outside the EU, or it's like the semi-membrane that still tries to interact somehow? How do you see it?
Honestly, I don't think we'll have that much difference. Looking at the Johnson government, which I don't see going anywhere for anytime soon, they're more interested in the big picture issues, which they can sell on a poster, when it's the thing that would actually make the most difference is reforming regulation to finance, to data, to GMOs, all the things which they say they're planning on doing. But I'm not sure how much I trust them to actually do it well, because when it comes to it, there's going to be a lot of parliamentary and public scrutiny, because people think, oh, you're giving the banks an easier time, you'll cause another like 2008 style crisis, oh, you're allowing big tech to take over our data and profit off of what's ours. And there's only so much they can really do, and when Boris generally isn't willing to devote the time and effort to getting legislation path that is hard to pass with the exception of Brexit itself, he's just not prepared to do that. So I think we will have changes, and I think there will be areas where the UK is sort of better in, from a free market perspective than Europe, but I also think there'll be areas where we've slacked or where we've not improved, and we've lost quite a lot through our decision to leave the EU, and I'm not confident yet, but I try and remain optimistic that we will get enough from deregulating and opening new trade routes to get over everything we've lost from Brexit. But I'm still a quiet Brexit supporter, so I'm still hopeful that we can help push the government in the right way, but I guess we'll see.
And that concludes this week's episode of Consume. Thank you so much for listening. You can follow Tom Spencer on Twitter at TomJackSpencer, and of course follow the Consumer Choice Center at Consumer Choice C. As always, I'm your host, Bill Words. See you Thursday. You have to learn.